No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God.
Hello and welcome back to The Fear of God podcast. It's a whole new year and a whole renewed fear of God. Find all of your favorite foggy paraphernalia at thefearofgodpodcast.com. Now, every week here in the fog, we explore what scares us in order to find what saves us. And by we, I mean me, one of your hosts, Nathan Rouse.
And me, your other host, Reed Lackey.
Reed, welcome, friend.
Nathan, how you doing, man?
I'm all right. Reed, we are still in the thick of our annual foray into the horror films of the previous year. Year being 2023.
It's been a lot. There's just been a lot. Wide range in these films.
Yes.
Wide range.
Yes. We're going to continue it today with Totally Killer.
Yeah.
And joining us today, direct from the 80s, is Quarterly Queen and longtime friend of the fog. Was she even born in the 80s? Vera Gowdy.
Yeah, 85.
85. There it is.
This is canon on the pod as well. Like, yes, that has been identified.
Right before the birth of the NES Entertainment System, the Nintendo Entertainment System. How's everybody doing?
Doing great. I'm actually very excited for this episode. I've been reflecting, you know, we haven't really done this much on these episodes, but I have been thinking a lot about just the wide spectrum of movies from last year that we've been covering. We're covering a completely different out of nowhere film next week as well. And so I'm just like, man, to have Evil Dead Rise and Cocaine Bear and Skinamarink and Talk to Me, all of those in the same conversation series is just wild to me. It's just these
It'll
wild
get your head spinning.
Yeah, it really does. It's really crazy because they could not be more different from each other. It's just wild to me. So yeah, I don't have any much to observe beyond that, especially like when I was watching this one, which we'll get to in just a little bit. I was like, man, the 2023 was clearly all over the map. So I was like, okay, all right, we're here for it though.
I feel like, you know, Vera, gratitude that you're here because like you might be the sibling we didn't have when we started the show at this point. And, you know, building up to right now, it's been kind of a lot of people. And so even that it's just the three of us, it's like, whew. You know,
yeah, actually, Nathan's feeling some relief. He's like, oh, okay,
can relax. I love everybody we've had, but it's been a lot, you know? And so now it's just three of us like, okay, so what do y'all want to talk about?
I want to talk about this movie, is what I want to talk about.
That's right.
I appreciate the nice segue there. However, instead of talking about this movie this immediate moment, it is in fact time.
It's gonna time be a good travel.
One. See, I went back in time and said the wrong word, and then immediately came right back forward in time and paired it off with the wrong word. Yes,
I'm leaving all that in.
That was a lot of work. Vera, Reed, it is time to go to our patron segment where we have been traipsing through a TV guideposts run discussing Mike Flanagan's Netflix series, The Fall of the House of Usher. So sit tight, listeners. We will be right back. So, about this movie. Okay.
Totally.
Are you gonna start doing a little jingle? little lucky jingle. Okay, so today we are discussing last year's Totally Killer. Okay. And the summary for Totally Killer is when the infamous Sweet 16 killer returns 35 years after his first murder spree to claim another victim. 17-year-old Jamie accidentally travels back in time to 1987, determined to stop the killer before he can start. Okay. Righteous.
Tubular.
Yeah, dude. I love how you're invoking, maybe not intentionally, but maybe intentionally, Crush from Finding Nemo. Like
It was weird. It was a little Keanu in there, a little, sure, you know, yeah, little Whoa. The Californians from SNL. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I get it. Well, if you'll permit, Vera, you, I think, on the Fear of God show, were the first to kind of unreservedly sing the praises of this film. So I want to give you some runway to lead off. Yeah, what'd you think about this?
I was bitching.
Put a quarter in the jar, Vera.
That I know. I can't remember why I watched it. Maybe somebody else on the Fog did and posted it in the group. But one day I was looking for something to watch and I was like, yep, okay, this one, sure, fine. But I watched it and I loved it. I had so much fun with it. I love a good horror comedy. I find that they don't come around often enough. Like, it either leans to like B-movie and like Sharknado, it's like straight horror, right? But like to find the balance, like the werewolf one from a couple years back, loved that one. Happy Death Day to you, and I love this one. I just really appreciate it. I liked the sort of homage to Back to the Future, which I thought was really cool. And I thought that a lot of the contrast between 80 sensibilities and Gen Z sensibilities was well done.
Yes.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Very, very much. Very, very much. I'm with you on this. So I heard this movie was going to be coming out. My wife and I made it a destination movie the weekend that it was released to Prime. So this was a Prime original. Like, that's how it was distributed. And so literally it was a weekend night. I can't remember if it was like a Friday or a Saturday, but literally my wife and I were like, this is what we're watching tonight. This is going to be fun. And I remember the first time through, I loved it from first viewing, but I remember the first time through, there were a couple things, like, you know, maybe I'll point out a couple of minor quibbles that I have. But so on the same wavelength for what you were describing there of just like such a fun horror comedy. It's not too extreme on it. Well, it's pretty funny. I was going to say it's not too extreme on either end, but I laugh a lot during this movie. And I feel like it's very, very lightweight. It's really accessible. Like, if somebody's like, oh, I don't like horror movies very much. Well, this is not too bad. Like, this one's fine. Like, there's a couple scenes.
It is light on the horror.
Yeah.
But it is horror. Yeah,
exactly. And what I really appreciate about it is it's, well, let me do this. And Nathan, I know you've got to share your similar thoughts on this, but let me lead with a couple of criticisms that I would have, because then I'm just going to heap an avalanche of praise on the film. So a couple things that still two viewings in kind of sit with me, with the distinct exception of the quantum drop scene at the end, the film's visual aesthetic is very sort of clinical and plastic to me. It actually reminded me of the visual aesthetic of like the show Cobra Kai. Like, it's very brightly lit. There's not a lot of texturing to the scene setups, and so it's just very, this is going to sound like a bad comment, but it almost feels visually like a TV movie. Like, it doesn't have a lot of dynamics to its visual aesthetic, and that threw me a little bit when I was first watching. I was like, oh, is this like really low rent in terms of like their production aesthetic? And even more contrasted by how different that is in the quantum drop scene in the climax, which is very visually dynamic. And suddenly it feels like they've got a new DP on board. I don't know where that movie was for an hour and 30 minutes, but visually that never really vibed for me. The other thing that I would point to is I feel like the jokes that work in this film have about an 85 to 90% hit rate, where like most of the jokes are really strong. There's a good 10 to 15% of them for me that are a little bit like, like a little eye roll, a little bit of like, okay, all right. It feels like they were just trying to throw one more thing out here. Again, the joke ratio is so strong that it never really bothers me, but there are a couple of moments in there where I'm just like,
fair.
No, like, eh, that one doesn't totally land. One that I will point to that just did not work for me at all is when Kieran Shipka's character like gets pushed back from the door and she's like, unwanted touch, unwanted touch. I'm like, huh? Like it felt like a joke without a laugh track. But fundamentally, like that's really it. Like those two notes aside, my God, I love this movie. Like,
did you ever watch The Pentaveret with Mike Myers on Netflix?
No, I remember when it came out, but no, I did not
there's
watch that.
A really, like, it's a mess show overall, but there's a really funny gag in the show where they start off in Canada and he plays a Canadian is he a journalist? I think he works for like the CBC, Canadian Broadcast Corporation, and he is going across the border into the States. And as they cross the border, they show like a wide shot. And as his van crosses the border, it goes from like grainy to HD because Canadian television is notoriously like not great shot. But that's
funny.
What I felt like totally killers cinematography was kind of Canadian.
Yes. Okay. Totally get that. And yeah, and you know, it's just kind of I don't know exactly what it was in the production that kind of made them go that way, but I totally gel with that. Now, those are a couple of notes that kind of don't work for me about the film. So much that does. I feel like this film deeply understood that if you're going to like this movie, this is what you're after, which is like an 80s nostalgia that's accessible, that's not too self-serious, that's rarely self-congratulatory, but is self-aware. Like, we know what we're doing. We understand the dynamics and why somebody might be vibing with this kind of piece. Venus by Bananarama being what, you know, she emerges into the 80s into, you know, little touches like that. They're like I just feel like the film and the creatives all understood, like, this is what's going to hook them. This is why we're here. This is what we're intending to do. Don't try to do anything else or reinvent the wheel. Just do this. And I feel like that really works. I feel like Kieran Shipka hits a bullseye for her performance because she's got just the right air of superiority to never feel pretentious, but to always feel a little bit like you're not going to keep doing that, you know? And it's like that character needs that. It needs that bite to it. But if it goes too far, then you're not on board for the character. Then you don't like the character because she's such a snob and whatever like that. And Shipka just does such a great job, I think, threading that needle that is really, really difficult to do. But I think all the characters and all of the cast really understand their role in it, from the incredibly difficult to pull on sort of nuance that Kieran Shipka has to portray to the literal one note recurring joke character of the jock who keeps coming. It literally like comes in and grabs his crotch and that's his
burps in her face.
Yes. But even for characters like that, show up, deliver the line, back out of the scene. You know, it's like they have such a great balance and rhythm to how they deploy so many of these different characters. So that really, really worked for me. And it's just funny. It's really, really, really funny. If there was another ding, though, I did not dislike this about this movie, is if you are looking for, well, I want to be scared too, this is not quite that movie. This is not going to be that movie. Now, Nathan, this was your first time seeing it. I don't know how much prep work you did beforehand or how much you heard or read or knew, but what'd you think going into it?
Well, all I knew was it was, you know, kind of, it's a weird way to think about it. So like, I understood it was going to have a style. Mm-hmm. And I think at some point I knew there was a time travel component to it, but I'd forgotten that part. And so then once it starts to present that, I was like, oh, that's right. That's right. That's what this is. So yeah, knew very little going in about the inner workings of the plot. Although, as has already been mentioned, things like, you know, Happy Death Day and several others like this, you know, once the inklings of a shape start to be revealed, the whole shape is revealed, right? Like, oh, okay, I know what this is more or less going to be. And I, you know, I appreciate your note there, Reed. Like, for me, the first 15 minutes or so weren't a great portent for what I was worried would be the whole thing. I will be a little harsher to what I was feeling early, was like, this feels like Nickelodeon level, like, production. And in a way that I was like, wait a minute, there's, I don't, you know, it wasn't a conscious, there's gotta be more to this. It was more just like, okay. So I really didn't care for a lot of that first little run, and just even down to, and again, this is me bellyaching a little bit to, you know, hooray, come around the other side with a more positive tone. But like, even when the inciting moment for her travel was the fake knife jammed into the plastic, you know, a control panel of the the time machine thing, it's like, that looks terrible, y'all. you know, so Reed, I'm very on board with your note there. I don't know if that was a bone thrown my way or not, but definitely,
no, it's sincere.
Definitely felt that in the early going of the film. Then fell asleep, or did I? If you end up getting to the patron segment or wait until the House of Usher complete conversation, you'll learn my viewing experience of this. So had a brief fugue state that entered my consciousness here, and then once I did pick the film back up, was able to get all the way to the end. And here's my takeaways right now for Totally Killer is, I don't, things I don't like are the production quality of the front end, and I actually find the design of the killer pretty lame. Like, I just don't, I know it's meant to be kind of Max Headroom-y and a little kind of that throwback sort of look, but I think it is not, there's nothing to me entrancing, intriguing, captivating, mysterious about that aesthetic, in ways even like, I don't love Happy Death Day as much as everyone, kind of even on this call, even though I think the first one is fantastic. I think the second one is just okay. But that, the baby look, that's very well designed. You know, it's weird. It's off-putting. You don't really know how to think about it. It's very dissonant in what it creates in response from you. Whereas this, it's just kind of like, oh yeah, kind of the greaser sort of look, even though that's, you know, not the 80s, but y'all understand what I'm saying. So didn't love that first run, didn't love the design of the killer. Once she gets in the past and the movie starts to find its feet, I'll frame it this way, retroactive shots fired here. Ultimately, I don't think Cocaine Bear is a funny movie. I didn't really enjoy it that much.
We know.
It is I was not that open on that. I was trying to be a courteous host and podcaster. I can say now, and for particular reasons I'll get to momentarily, Cocaine Bear has a particular note that it bangs over and over and over until the end, and then it's over. This, to me, once it finds its feet with her in the past, it is quite funny. And if I will give this film any... And it is not empty. It is very high praise. The script is very strong. Like the you know, to your point, Reed, that's a hell of a ratio when you can say 10% of these jokes don't work. Because what that actually says, 90% of this stuff more or less works, you know.
That's right.
And is either amusing or causes me to chuckle or is outright funny, you know,
clever.
And I don't know that I would say in its entirety the cast is great or anything, but to what has already been said, Karen Shipka, she has this like wearied modern energy to her that works well as the oh my god, you guys are saying this thing again kind of energy. like it works well. So anyway, in short, I think I am finding a sort of consistent note here that Nathan needs better scenarios in which he watches movies for the first time and or needs opportunity to rewatch, which is just not really the case often. Because I do think in a more appropriate setting to what the movie's delivering, that what started as neutral would have started a little higher and thus gotten even higher by the end of it. Whereas, and this is me sort of naming it, like what started neutral to borderline question mark by the end was very much appreciative of what it was doing, and genuinely enjoying it. Like, I'm going to invite us in the moment, if we're open to it, to drop some lines that we found fun, humorous, or otherwise enjoyable.
I would love that. I think the
script is great. I think she's great. I don't love the killer design. Or
the girl that plays the young mom, I thought was really good too. She's
great. Yeah.
Looks like Julie Bowen.
Yes.
Like a young version of her. And she did a really great job.
Yeah. I wholeheartedly agree. That was Olivia Holt. And I feel like the dynamic between Shipka and her younger mother is really endearing. I feel like that whole dynamic is endearing from the first moment. Like, and it didn't have to be necessarily, but I think the two of those actors find some real chemistry that makes their scenes crackle a little bit more than just, oh, we know that this character is talking to her younger mom. There's a kind of an automatic camaraderie that emerges, an automatic impressiveness once young Pam realizes that this girl has taken karate and can literally like defend herself against the jock in the party scene. So I just really enjoyed their scenes. You know who else I loved in it is I loved the character, and I'm going to do my best with her name, Troy Leanne Johnson, who plays the young version of Lauren Creston, the genius with the time travel thing. Loved that character's performance. I just love that she's like listening to all of it, very like flat faced, listening to everything. And then her one point is like, nobody knows about my notebook, you know? And then I loved to your point, Nathan, about the script. And this wasn't a line I would have cited out, but just I'm praising the script right now to say like, you're taking this very well. It's just like, well, you don't think about time travel without imagining the possibility that somebody's going to come back and need your help. it was really great. This is what I mean by the film not being self-aware, but not being self-congratulatory. They just decide to hang a lantern right there. It's like, well, yeah, of course, I'm conceptualizing time travel. You don't think I envisioned that something like this might happen? You know, like, it's just it's really, really, really strong. This time around, specifically, more so than the first time, and then I'll shut up and let us get to some funny lines, maybe as a segue. The first time around, I just enjoyed the whole piece. This time around, what stood out to me the most is, in agreement with what we've all said, I think it's a very strong script. I think it's a really, really strong script. Not only the joke ratio, but the story keeps me guessing. Like, they change up like who gets killed and what order and what's really happening and location settings and dynamics and everything. And so it kept me guessing as to who's behind all of it and what the little reveals are. I'm like, okay, all right. Yeah. Like, it didn't have to work too hard to create all these little machinations. I loved it.
I will say of that, and this is, I'm pulling a read here of saying I called it when. So it's late now. I would challenge anyone to call who the second killer is. By the way, there's ultimately two here. Spoiler alert. that is one of the brilliant turns of the final act of the film. Is like, oh yeah, that would have been truly hard to guess. But the first one, who I can't remember his name, but you know, the hall monitor guy.
Yeah.
So his boyfriend.
Yes. So when one of his last scenes, I was just like, it's him. Yeah, I didn't even totally know exactly why, but I was like, it's definitely. So did
Rob.
Guy.
Rob said because the list of potential killers was getting thin.
Sure. Yeah. And you got to show, him one more time to remind us that he's here, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
I did. Doggone it. Oh, Reed, you were talking about, or generally speaking, we're talking about scripting stuff. What is pretty impressive is not just so. I didn't do this reading. I just didn't have time for it, but I'm kind of curious like what the onset experience was like, because I would be surprised if there was a cut loose freestyle improv, whatever you want kind of energy, because it does feel pretty, you know, there are still kind of rules the narrative has to follow. And so you got to keep it relatively on the tracks, and individually scenes don't themselves feel like sketches, which can happen in these improvisational sort of settings. But there are a number of times, and I'm going to point specifically to Kiernan Shipka because she's who I primarily remember. Like, there are a number of throwaway lines that are genuinely funny, that are just kind of not foregrounded, not, you know, I don't know if they were scripted or not, or, and maybe they found it on set, but they feel like discoveries in the moment. And so,
yeah,
you know, some of that is really just fun. So, so yeah, if y'all are open to it, let's just do a couple rounds here of just identifying some fun moments. This is not a line, but, and so I'll start with you, Vera, but I did want to highlight Reed, cause you referenced, starting with Venus when she comes back. Brilliant needle drop of Lady in Red when redheaded Tiffany is getting killed, which is just a great song, but is also just a great needle drop when that happens. Like, okay, okay, you're starting to win me over, movie, with a, with something like that.
It's great.
Vera, what's the line you want to highlight?
Go first. So it's not, I have two and they're both not lines, but I'll do the first one first because that's how numbers work. My favorite scene is when she bags the blood from the killer and gives it to Asian Jim. And he's like, DMA, what's DMA? And she's like, trying to explain it. She's like, it's a thing they all, you have, I don't know what it is. And he just takes the bag. And he's
like, the worldwide database. Like, yeah.
Gross.
That was a really telling scene too. I was like, oh God. The world is accelerating too fast.
Oh my god, oh man, and I love it. I think when
that
he retorts back to her, he was like, oh yeah, we'll search the worldwide DMA database.
Yeah.
purposefully missays it. Oh my god, it's so funny, so funny. Nathan, you can go next.
I will cite one of the ones I was just referring to with the throwaway lines. There's a great, like, I had to rewound it 5 seconds to make sure I heard what I thought I heard. And it's when Julie, who is Shipka's character, has been locked out of the cabin. And she's trying to get back in. And she's, like, scaling the roof line or whatever. And literally, it is a wide shot. You know, it is not up close of her. It is not focusing on her. And she just says, I should just chop all of you up at this point. Just one of those great little bits. It's like, it would not surprise me if that was not scripted and they just found it on the day. Reed, you do one.
Okay. Oh my God. Okay. So we're doing lines. There's actually
moments. Yeah.
Okay. There's one moment that I was like, oh my God, there's actually two that I think of that are just like, oh my God. But, okay, so I'll do this one. This is the biggest one for me. When she gets a ride to the police station, and when she emerges from the station wagon and just a waft of cigarette smoke is just barreling out of it.
Yeah.
It's just a great visual sight gag. But I'm going to piggyback off of it, because right before it pulls up, the line I would cite from that is when the sheriff is saying, he just starts with, the scene opens with him going, old people, sick people, and people with dogs. And then the guy goes, that's the order you hate people in? He goes, yep. And the guy goes, that's a good order. It's just really, really, really funny. I have one more if nobody else mentions it, but yeah, we can go back around for another round.
Just to piggyback on yours a little bit, this isn't my second one, but the lady who gives her the ride, and how she's like, no, come on, I'll give you a ride. And he's like, no, I can't, you're a stranger. It's like, it's the 80s, man.
So
and the station wagon is so, it's so funny. The wood paneled ugly car. Anyway, but my second one is, you mentioned earlier about things that change as they go, as she's back in time. Mm-hmm. And the Killer Instinct poster that changes to a waterbed away. Oh,
that's funny. Yeah.
It's so funny.
Well, to me, if I'm allowed to tag onto there, that is very funny. What was hysterical is when you learn at the end, it says he named his album that because it's how close he was to death.
Yeah, well, he was just a waterbed away.
Oh my God, so funny.
That's a good one. I love, it's another one of these just little blink and you miss it moments, but I think the character is Marissa. When they're going through the Dollhouse of Horrors at the end, she's trying to subject herself to be bait to draw the killer out. And she's wandering through this you know, hell house. And she's in a room. And again, this is several of these characters.
The corpses hanging?
Are very lascivious and randy characters. And she's walking past. It's a hung upside down. It's the bottom half of a woman strung upside down, right? So legs and rear end into abdomen, and it's just clothed in undergarment. And Marissa's passing it, and she goes, "I have those panties." Just like those jokes that just don't have to be there. Like, yes. You know, that's sort of a creepy scene, and her going through it is has a certain effect to it, but just to drop that kind of line in there, just hysterical.
God. One that had me guffawing was the PE teacher, where she arrives with the PE teacher, and then at first she's like, "Oh no, and she's like, no, you know, like, get in here." And then she's like, "Okay, God, like, fine." And so she starts moving, and then that was funny enough. But then the PE teacher's like, "Oh, you're gonna fill it in real great here." Ooh, and then does this visual affectation. Listeners can't see it, but like, she does this real like exaggerated shoulder swap thing over the, oh my God, it was that scene. It was just hysterical to me.
I had my grade five teacher was like that, like very sarcastic and would like, did not take any back talk and would just rip into students. And it reminded me of Mr. Button so much.
So great. I gotta give an honorable mention to FBI Federal Booby Inspector. My God, that made me laugh so much. It's like, she's just looking at it, just like, that shirt is very problematic. It's just, oh my God.
And the guy's girlfriend's like, "I love your shirt, babe."
That's what's so great. Oh my God, it's funny. There are too many to name, but I did love, again, there were a couple that I was like, okay, well, that one didn't quite land, but nearly all of the whole, man, weren't the 80s ridiculous? Nearly all of the jokes that they leveraged for that were just absolutely hysterical. Yeah, I'm surprised, Nathan, you didn't mention the old Prince Edward Island connection that I thought was really, really fun. where she's like, "I'm from Prince Edward Island." And yeah. Then,
what's he saying? Is that a real place or something?
Yeah, it's like, and she's like, "It is." And then when he said like, "Oh yeah, I looked it up. You know what the average age there is? It's like 49 and a half." And she's like, "Oh, great." Oh my God, it's so funny.
Well, if I can, one, we did not call this out, but just for the sake of the foggers at home, a really great bit of Julie trying to describe the movie Scream was really fun. you know, I think for me, I would hesitate to say this is a hyper thoughtful, super, you know, kind of conscientious, like it has something to say. But I actually was really, I know this is a hard pivot out of just jokey stuff, but like, I think what it put me in mind of that I do think holds value for at least a thread of conversation is two thoughts. One, how, and I feel like I beat a dead horse on this show sometimes of even doing this, you know, of how much our present state and intellect and who we are right now feels at odds with what has been, and oh man, I can't believe, and we say sometimes, or I say sometimes, like, I know this is the me now saying this thing, and I don't feel good about how that thing was or whatever. So it definitely calls to mind that, but more than that, I think what's actually kind of heartening about this film is, while I wouldn't suggest or say that this movie is trying to give a pass to some of the excesses that these characters are exhibiting as Julie's encountering them, I think how it impacted me was just kind of the grace we can exercise towards our past self and or our past misunderstanding or our past lack of understanding or our past position on a thing. You know, I don't think the movie is about this group of characters is enlightened by the girl from the future and suddenly they're woke. You know, I don't think that's the point, but this idea that who we were at one point, despite perhaps saddled with thoughts, views, perspectives, philosophies that we either don't feel that strongly about anymore or we actively reject at this point, that we really can have grace towards that, the person who held those views and had those ideas and had those thoughts, and don't have to just, you know, be hyper dismissive of the us in that scenario, or you know, hear me, that can be taken too far. I think the two of you are wise and sensitive enough to understand the point I'm trying to make, and our listeners will too. But I don't know, I was struck by that sensibility about this film. It wasn't so much, oh, look at the shenanigans the girl from the future gets into with the crazy things of the past. But at least for me, whether this was active in the film or not, it put me in that frame of mind of just like, you know, there is the dark note to incorporate here is the sad aspect of the fact that adolescent life today is not allowed to screw up. Like, yeah, it's just not allowed to be wrong and to kind of get it wrong and to kind of be dummies. And that's really sad to me, in ways I don't know that I've fully apprehended. But that aside, just this idea that you can have grace and forgiveness towards the stupidity of your younger self is really fascinating, is really interesting. I don't know how, you know, intentional that concept was or how much it was borne out by the fruit of, we have this concept and let's pursue it. But that's sort of what the film put in mind for me. I don't know if y'all have any thoughts or feedback on that concept.
I could leap all over it, but Vera, I want to give you some runway.
Look out.
No, go ahead.
Bounce. No, I'm
you're just a waterbed away, brother.
I'm a waterbed away.
We're all waterbed away.
my aunt and uncle used to have a waterbed. They're the only people in my life that I knew had one. But I think so let me get the analytical, critical film critic hat put it on for just a second, get out of the way. I agree with you that I don't think the film was very deliberate with some of that. I think that emerges organically. I don't feel from this film that they are trying to posit that, but I feel like it is kind of unavoidable in the DNA of what they did intentionally put here, that concept emerges. And it's something that I find, like you suggested, that I find incredibly heartening. I think about for myself the kind of rhetoric that I used to use when I was a kid. Grew up in a Southern conservative evangelical home in the 80s. I was a product of the 80s. So, you know, you think about, I'm hearing and reading all kinds of things in 2024 that call out conditions and rhetoric and very what would be viewed now as very problematic or very toxic sort of things that emerged from that culture. We think about things, I'll bring it into the horror realm. We think about things like the Satanic Panic, and we have the luxury of looking back on that and being like, oh man, but I lived in that. I remember hearing those stories. I remember hearing that's the threat of these horror movies that I love. And I'm like, oh crap. Well, what do I do? I'm going to still watch one. But like, honestly,
show me another one.
Show me another one. But, when I think about so much of what I didn't know then, I think there's this real superior attitude that can emerge, that can look back on that and say like, oh, you should have known better. I think that's very different than saying, hey, you should learn better, or we should learn together better, to do better, to be better. Thankfully, we have learned a lot now. But I do have a lot of grace for not only my former self, but also many other people's former selves. I mean, I think there's certain things, again, to your point, Nathan, we can overqualify this thing to death. Some people are going to hear, oh, have grace for former things we didn't know, and then go immediately to like extremities that are far beyond the pale. Like, sure, that's not what we're talking about. When you think about the ways that they make punchlines out of the things that were incredibly normative in the 80s. My wife just earlier today, this is not the 80s, this is like the 90s, but my wife just earlier today was watching some old Saved by the Bell episodes that were just on, and commented a couple of times about like, oh my God, that line rings an alarm bell these days. And they threw it out casually and the whole in-studio audience laughed uproariously at it. You know, it's just we didn't recognize the things that we recognize now. And there's two ways to approach that kind of conversation. One false way would be how a lot of people try to respond and be like, oh, we're too sensitive, PC, you know, enough of this PC nonsense. You should just say whatever's on your mind. I was like, I mean, yeah, you can choose to be an asshole if you want to go through your life that way. You can do that. That's a choice you can make. But I don't think that that's a very healthy or forward-moving kind of view to have. The other thing that you can do is you can kind of make it this sacrosanct kind of thing that's like, oh my God, now that we've learned this thing, then we absolutely can't fathom or can't imagine how we ever used to have another perspective. And to me, I'm like, there's so much value to me. I'll use parenting as an example. Like, I'm not going to be the best parent I can be if I don't remember what it was like to be a kid. I'm not going to be. If I'm constantly parenting from this place, you talked, Nathan, in our Lake Mungo episode about condescending to the place, you know, not condescending in a superiority fashion, but condescending, like lowering yourself and remembering like, oh my God, this is what this was like. And I feel like this grace you're talking about towards our former selves is an incredibly valuable exercise, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, to just recognize like, I didn't know,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I don't have to be that anymore. I can't be that, you know, because of what I've learned. But I can at least look back at that and mentally and emotionally give that person a hug rather than a wagging finger. I can at least look back and be like, you didn't know, kid. Like you didn't know how harmful that would be. Look at the things that were said to you. They didn't realize how harmful that would be. And it's just being able to exercise that kind of grace towards ourselves, I think, fosters and grace is very different than self-justification. To finish the sentence I cut myself off for, I think when you exhibit grace to yourself, it cultivates your ability and capacity to show grace towards others. But that's very different than self-justification. Self-justification closes it off and be like, don't hold me accountable for any of that. I didn't know what I was doing. You know, like it's a very reactive kind of shove it away, which is not a spirit or attitude of learning. I think you can hold some regret and you can hold some tension of remorse and still say, I didn't know, you know, I didn't understand. Yeah. It's a posture of grace that I think is, to quote the line from Calvary, for people who have not seen the movie Calvary, the line will speak for itself. But he said, we concentrate a lot on vices and not enough on virtues. And then the person he's talking to on the phone says, which virtue is your favorite? And he said, I think forgiveness has been grossly underrated. So that was a lot of word salad. I'm going to hush and let Vera go.
Yeah, I like what you're both onto. I found that the movie wasn't super laden with theme.
Sure.
However, if you could pull something out of it, I think that what it wants us to take away is that we all have the ability to break a cycle. And I think that time travel element that is used to go back into the past and change the past is part of it. It's the big thing, but the little pieces that we're talking about, the changing attitudes, like the things that they hang a lantern on that were like, yes, they're funny in the sense of the movie, but when you think about why things have changed from then until now, there's reason and purpose for that. And it's because we've grown for the most part as a society into the language, for the most part, that we try to use with one another is more compassionate and more thoughtful, and that we don't have to continue to do those things just because they always have been done. And sure, there are people out there who are going to, you know, oh, you're so soft. Oh, we used to be so much better, black, right? And it's because they're looking at it through the lens that this movie is giving us, which is the nostalgic glasses, right? Because looking back in time, things seem better, but were they really? Like, think about all of the groups of people that were marginalized, how they were marginalized and why they were marginalized, and how much better things, for the most part, are for them today.
It makes me so sad you have to keep qualifying, though I totally get it and understand and resonate. You know, it's funny that I think, and hopefully, one here, my friend of near 25, one here, my friend of 5+, you know, would echo this. I don't know that I bring a ton to the table in my life necessarily, but openness is just one of those things I've always, it wasn't even a conscious choice at one point, but just to, you know, just to stay curious, stay open, stay listening, you know, don't dismiss a thing too quickly. And yet, even though I would laud that on a certain level of like, this is how I try to be in the world, even then you get confronted sometimes with just, you know, kind of challenges to that notion. And it's funny, just two slight instances here. Like, my older two kids go to an art school. Well, as you can imagine, an art school in 2024 in a major metropolitan area, it is just rife with progressive, you know, persons and and philosophies. And, you know, my oldest kid is probably more progressive minded than even I am. She just doesn't know how to articulate it in some of the same ways. But I remember she has a friend, a peer, who's kind of uses they them pronouns, and she, my daughter, was referencing this friend, and I, just because it's old hat, referenced she in of this person, and may have done it more than once, and my kid got onto me, and I was like, mm-hmm. Hey, mm-hmm. I hear you. I'm learning too, though. Like, have grace for me. I'm not trying to offend or insult right now. I will, like this is all adjustment, right? This is all learning. I am still a 44-year-old dude from the South who can still learn things. And so I'm happy to learn the things. Don't be mad at me while I learn the thing, you know? And I've got a peer here locally whose child has, you know, kind of come out as trans, and mm-hmm. this person, the peer of mine is 10 years older than me. And so you've already got that much more kind of life built up of not totally understanding all this stuff. And I was hanging out with him recently and kind of imparted some empathy and compassion. I was like, hey man, like, have some compassion on yourself. Like, you, mm-hmm. this is going to be a challenge regardless. Like, you are a good, open-hearted person who loves their child, and you got to have some grace on your own self as you sort of figure out how to speak, you know, how to love this person well, and to walk into that with grace. But in the meantime, don't beat yourself up for learning, you know, and just what that, and those are two real specific unique examples, but just that idea of, I think this idea got at least pointed to, you know, in the last 10 minutes or so, but this idea that forgiveness of self, willingness to learn, continued, you know, because you'll get down this path over here and suddenly realize, oh crap, totally neglected that thing that I didn't even know was a thing, but I'm happy to join that fight too, you know. Well, and I don't know, just that concept is real heartening to me.
Well, and what you talked about too, I have too many thoughts on this subject for them to fit in concisely here, but I think a lot about the demand to have arrived already at a place that we are growing into. That is a real tension in my heart and mind, where I'm just like, you know, the liberty to get it wrong when you're framed towards trying to get it right. I think it can be counterproductive to be hyper militant about that and say like, oh, well, you, case in point, hey, if I'm in the process of learning, well, I'm not going to learn as effectively if I'm constantly afraid of getting my hand slapped. Now, that's a different impulse than somebody saying like, oh, well, don't ever correct and don't ever. No, you can guide, you can reinforce, you can instruct, you can help to coach and train and move along the way with a spirit of grace and with a heart of compassion. There's all of those things that can happen, and I feel like the contrast that people want to make is how it was versus how it is. That's the contrast that people seem to want to be drawn into. Oh, well, this is how it was, and now it's how it is. And you hear a lot of people fighting about like, well, I think this is stupid, so we're going to take it back to where it was. And I think for myself, the contrast should be more openness versus closedness for me. That's like an openness to learning, as you said, but also an openness to recognizing like, oh man, there's a really silly line in here, but I'm bringing it back to Totally Killer for a second, is, oh my God, I didn't write it down because I never would have imagined referencing this line in this, but I think it's very, very relevant, is where she's talking to the creepy kid out there, and he's talking about like Lurch. Yeah. She's talking to Lurch. And I don't know why I'm whispering, but she's talking to Lurch, and then and he's like, you know, how do you know it wasn't Eddie? And he was like, oh, he told me all about that night. I looked it up. He told me all about that night, but then left as soon as she said she didn't do BJs. And then
I wrote that line down. Yeah.
And then he says, and then when he says, like, maybe if she did do BJs, she'd still be alive. And then she goes, but let's not make that the lesson.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm referencing this very, very clever, very funny line to say, it is possible to learn the wrong things and to move in unhealthy directions. That's very possible. But I think that's why the tension is not to strike a balance between what was and what is, but to strike a balance between, let me not be closed off. Let me not be unreceptive. Let me not be so stubbornly blinded, self-blinding to who this person is in front of me and what they are offering to this moment, to this conversation, who they are. God grant me the grace to like have my eyes wide open, because there are a lot of people drawing battlegrounds around what is versus what was. And I largely find those conversations and those arguments very fruitless, very, very fruitless. Because if you're trying to convince somebody that they should come into what is when they're completely closed off, that's a futile endeavor. You might as well shake the dust off your feet and move on. Like, you're never going to take someone who is stubbornly convinced that what was better into a version of openness. But we can show grace and compassion and learn to be more open ourselves, both with what we used to know and with what we're learning, and towards others as well. And I find for myself, in my observations, that's significantly more valuable, because that's how real change can happen. I hope to God I'm not the same person at 60 as I am right now. Like, I hope I haven't stopped learning.
Us too, Creed.
I know. Everybody's wishing for it. Like, I used to get told when I was younger, and used to wear it as a kind of a badge of pride, you know, these older folks, because I was a very, very good church boy, were like, oh, he's wise beyond his years. And it's funny, because I look back at that now and I'm like, no, I mean, maybe I was instinctive about a couple of things, but God, the things I've learned in the last 20, 30 years, and the things I hope to God I learn in the next 20 to 30 years. I don't really want to be wise beyond my years. I want to have an openness to wisdom, to seek it. And I want to just be receptive to what I'm learning about my friends and my family. And sure, I can go mentally back in time, like this film has the opportunity to put in the real. But I really do hope that I look back on my 40-year-old self, my 43-year-old self, from my 63-year-old self. I hope I look back with as much grace and compassion as I look back now at my 23-year-old self and go like, man, all the things I would have said and done differently. But this is where I am now. And this is hopefully who I'm continuing. Never arrived, always just becoming. All right. I think I've said enough on that part. I probably said too much, but.
I look at like people have always said to me too, like, very mature for your age, like very like you get along so well with adults. And it's like, because you keep putting me in adult situations, causing me to interpret for my parents at the bank and at the doctor. And you know what I mean? Like, and I look at that and I look how far things have come for CODAs who are children nowadays, and how they are. People are so protective of not putting them in those situations. Mm. And I'm so thankful that we have come that far.
Yeah.
But there is always more to do and grow. And it's something like I have, for those that don't know, because why would you? I never talk about it. I have a TikTok, and my channel primarily, like, I do a lot of stuff on it, but primarily I answer people's questions about deaf culture and the deaf community. And something that I am thankful to see is how far we've come in terms of like access and accessibility and awareness. But also sometimes people can get a little bit militant in that, you know, like, you should know this and this is the right way to do things and we don't do it that way anymore. And I try my best to gently remind people that you don't know what you don't know. And we don't ever want to be a barrier to people learning, growing, and changing. And it's important that we exercise grace always, always, as much as possible, exercise grace.
Well, and it's something that comes to me there of just like, you know, there's grace for ignorance, then there's permission to permit ignorance, right? Those feel like kind of two different things. And I think a lot about, you know, I don't make this comment much because of how much you get kind of clapped back for it. But I remember a season where it's like, well, you know, these politicians and public figures, when, you know, some heinous story of, you know, I'm thinking specifically during like Me Too era, and it's like a public figure who's a man would come out and be like, as the father of daughters or as a husband of a wife, you know, and they get made fun of for that, kind of rightly so, because maybe not the place for that. And yet at the same time, I think, and what I'm saying, not the place for that, is simply the platform they choose to use.
Sure.
I'm actually empathetic to the sincerity of that statement, because I think there's this dumb idea we sometimes carry around with us that you're just fully formed and just do the right thing in all circumstances at all times without some sort of teaching or influence and whatever. And like, I'll be the first to own, I would say largely I think I was pretty, you know, compassionate or empathetic or whatever previous to A, being married and sort of pledging your life to someone, then, you know, B, having kids, C, having multiple kids, D, all of my kids being girls. But all of those things are teachers.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things force growth. Well, should force growth, are catalyzers to something. And I just think it's such a shame that even those who I would typically identify with as kind of progressive will choose occasionally to throw the stone of like, well, no, you should just know better. Like, well, maybe. But at the same time, what if you just don't know? No one taught you, and there wasn't a circuit or a thing that was created in your life that permitted you that growth. And so, you know, I do think there's a difference between permission to remain ignorant once that sort of reveals itself, or for the person who ventures out and makes themselves vulnerable and says, I'm kind of ignorant about this thing. Like, I really don't know. Is this okay for me to feel or think or whatever, and kind of grow that way.
And the capacity for self-shame is so vast. Like, we're going through something right now because he's 12 years old. We're going through something right now with my son where he will stumble into, at least, you know, once every couple of days, a phrase, a statement that he will make that he does not realize how hurtful the statement is. I'll use a very, very superficial example. He checked out this show that several of his friends at school like, this little cartoon YouTube show thing. I don't even really know much about it, but he watched it and he was like, oh my God, this is so stupid. And then for like 15 minutes after he finished watching the episode, he went on and he was about like, I'm going to let them know, like, oh my God, this show is kind of trash. And, you know, I really think this show is really dumb. And he said, I'll just tell them, you know, and I had to kind of guide in that moment and be like, well, let's think about this. Like, if they invite your honest opinion, you don't have to lie. You can tell them, I didn't like it. It wasn't funny to me. I didn't enjoy it. Not invoking that you should lie. I said, but that's very different than walking up to someone that you know already is connected to this thing and enjoys it and dumping on it. That's very, very different. Whole reason I'm illustrating that, and something that my son seems to kind of be going through right now, is we do have to learn. We have to figure out, like, oh, I didn't know that hurt. I didn't know that. I'm just expressing my opinion. I'm just saying a thing. To him, it's a very, very simple, very clear line. I'm supposed to be truthful, aren't I? Of course you're supposed to be truthful, but there's these layers and these impacts. We don't realize the power that we hold. And one of the things I love about this film that I do think is text, we're dancing with a lot of things that I think are just inferences from the premise and inferences from sort of what emerges. But one thing that I do think is text is we're terrified of change because we think change is going to be bad. This film textually says, no, change is very good. When she comes back, you know what I love? Love, love, love it so much. Such a simple little touch. But I love that the notebook that Lauren Creston gives her is titled Everything That's Different. I just love it. Everything that's different. Here's a primer on everything that's different. And it ends on such an upbeat note, a really funny, you know, final line for her, like effing time travel, you know, like it's just, it just ends on that great note and then goes through. But it's literal final philosophy statement is look at all this change and literally all of it's better. You got a new brother and a new family member. And
your mom isn't dressing up as a Molly Ringwald character every Halloween.
That's a win, you know? And it's like, and there's that. And even, you know, the actual killer of the film, you know, at least one of them is now off at a monastery. And I love that. It's like, we're keeping an eye on him though. You know,
yeah.
It's just like, but this undergirded philosophy that's like, yeah, change can be good. Change can be really, you know, you don't know. It's scary. It's terrifying, especially if it threatens the comfort levels that we're so accustomed to. But change doesn't have to be a bad thing. And I think being open to it, you know, and just being receptive to tell me about everything that's different, you know, just let me listen to everything that's different. Go ahead. Yeah.
It's like, it's like Nana Connie says when Marcel, the show with shoes on, fearing their parting, says, what if everything changes? She says, Michel, it will.
Mm-hmm.
It will. It's not it that, will. It's not that, you know, we have to invite it. It's gonna change.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just whether you've invited it or wish for it or resist it at all, it is gonna change. Speaking of changing, I think I've referred to Kiernan Shipka's character as Julie once or twice. I think I was channeling Julie Bowen. She is Jamie because
slash
at the end
Colette.
Yes, slash Colette. That's what put it back in mind. So I was like, well, they didn't name the brother Julie. That's a great little bit. But guys, listen. Mm. Listen. You know, we are just going all over woke town up in here. And lest we forget, we are a horror show. So, I mean, here in this home stretch, guys, if it's gory, if it's gross, if it causes you a fright, what scares you about this movie? What makes you say, that ain't right?
That ain't right, it ain't right, nothing right about it, no, it ain't right, no, it ain't right, no, that ain't right, it ain't right, it sure as hell ain't right, it sure as hell ain't right.
That ain't right, that ain't right, that sure as hell ain't right.
And you're both free to say, not a whole lot.
Not very scary.
I'm gonna go first only to give you all a chance to think, and it's nothing in text, and so I'm not stealing from anyone, hence my willingness to be you know, maybe a bad host in that regard.
The lead.
Speaking of things we can be thankful for, the that ain't right was almost the fact that I did, because Penny, my middle child, is on a scream run right now. She's seen all but four. And so she's growing into, as this 13-year-old, my little horror buddy that I haven't had up until now. I pondered showing her Totally Killer, and I didn't, just because the timing didn't work out, and Common Sense Media informed me that maybe some of the content might be questionable. And let me tell you how happy I am that I didn't have to sit through about 30 references to blowjob in this movie.
A lot of them.
13-year-old. There was a lot of it. I was like,
a lot of them.
That would have not been right. So, like, you know, present me is thankful that future me went back in time to talk to past me and said, don't do this, Nathan. So that was my that ain't right.
They keep saying, yeah, pee comes out of there.
Yeah. Oh, God. right.
They said it in, like, homage to her in the car.
Yes.
Then
yes.
They kiss the sky. Oh, yeah. My God. It's so funny. Oh, my God.
So that's so that is my that ain't right. Vera, what do you have on your list, if anything?
So, like Reed, I also only knew one person with a waterbed, and it was my across the street neighbors. And one time, like, we weren't allowed to go on the waterbed, but we obviously broke that rule all the time because it's a waterbed, and it's like, when you're a kid, you're like, this is cool and fun. But one time, Corey, so they had two kids, Corey and Courtney. So Courtney was my friend. Corey's my brother's friend. Corey was not a great kid. He's wonderful now. He's got a family. He's great. But as a kid,
we can grow.
He grew. Yes. He grew. And anyway, him and my brother were play fighting on the bed, and it sprung a hole. waterbed sprung a hole, and they had a carpeted bedroom, as was the back in the 90s. Right. And so you can imagine waterbed springs a leak and just soaks the carpet, and it's a nightmare. So my that ain't right is why he got to stab her on the waterbed and on the carpeted bedroom. And just not only is she dead, but now it is a bloody, watery mess. They got to write off that hole upstairs.
Yeah.
That ain't right.
Oh.
Insurance ain't covering that.
Insurance is not
that ain't right.
That.
Yeah.
That ain't
right. Homeowner's insurance. I got a dead body, but that's not my problem.
No, my real problem is.
Yeah.
I was a waterbed.
Now there's a leak to the downstairs from the waterbed.
Right.
You were always one waterbed away from terrible home insurance. So yeah, I struggled, y'all, for that ain't right from this. I was gonna maybe reference the very, very rampant references to to fellatio. And then also just, I mean, like, yeah, you could point to a couple of the deaths that are just like, okay, sure, but even they are not dreadfully gruesome. I actually think Tiffany's death is probably the worst of it. And so I guess broadly speaking, like my that ain't right is just going to be the ways in which they constantly are running up against sensibilities from the 80s that just continue to, you know, it's just a broad, it's played for a lot of laughs, it played for a lot of jokes, but just the way that you look back at that and like, oh yeah, yeah, that was pretty casually racist. Oh yeah, it's completely insecure. I love that when she walks away from the secretary at the school and she's like, man, going on a plane right now must be wild. You know, like,
the name of the school.
Oh, yes.
They're, in the future, they're the devils. But in the past, she's like, and there's the racism because they're.
I forget. What are they? What are they?
They're the Red Devils.
Red Devils. Oh, that's right. Wow. Oh, yeah. My God. Yes, 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 yes. So I think broadly speaking, my that ain't right is just like, yes, some of those very 80s sensibilities. It's easy in nostalgia to glorify times as simpler and better and easier. But like we've already gone over many, many times, that's often hiding some things that are just kind of like, ooh, yeah, okay, so maybe not now. Like, maybe don't repeat that. And, you know, maybe don't go there anymore. I just thought,
maybe not make that the lesson.
Let's maybe not make that the lesson. Yeah. Exactly. But I loved, so it's a that ain't right into one of my biggest praises for the film, which is they leverage a lot of those for very clever and effective punchlines that are genuinely very funny. They leverage most of those and circled up into there. If I was going to mention one more thing, it was going to be that, like, they came to a cabin for a party and all they seemed to have brought was like alcohol. Like, that's all they seem
and
to
brownies.
Brought.
Well, except
brownies.
For
brownies.
Vodka. She forgot vodka. But
she forgot vodka. Exactly. Thank
the,
goodness.
The brownies, yep.
Yeah, but it's literally just like, yeah, pot brownies, and very, very weak, ineffective pot brownies, and the alcohol, that's all they brought. They didn't even have the stuff to throw together a pizza. That's all. The apple slices and bread, that ain't right pizza. So, yeah.
At the condo. I mean, maybe she
that was funny. That was funny. A borderline that ain't right is I did think the Dollhouse of Horrors was pretty well realized.
Yeah,
that was,
yeah, yeah.
That was
yeah.
a fun set.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, if you're gonna go in there, then yeah. I think you should be prepared to see anything.
Yeah, that was a great line. That was really funny. It's on you what you see in the Dollhouse of Horrors. Well, guys, did you squirm? Did you wince? Did you squint your eyes real tight? It's probably because of what we around here might in other films have called that ain't right.
That sure as hell ain't right.
Oh, gosh. All right. So as has been our recent pattern, kind of zipping out of that ain't right into the fog meter. So the fog meter for the film Totally Killer, which was directed by Nanochka Khan, multiple writers on this. I'm not trying to shortchange them, but fog measure is our specific to the show metric where we grade these films, not necessarily on their quality, but on their gravity, on what they ask of you as the viewer. And we do that by fear and God. Fear, as you probably guess, is how scary, how gnarly, how disturbing the thing is. God is, you know, what does this film have on its mind and how effectively does it convey that? So Vera, I'm going to start with you. You can go ahead and give me both numbers, fear and God. What would you give Totally Killer?
First, I mean, as we've stated multiple times, it's not very scary. If it was the fun of God, it'd be up high. But if it's the fear, it's...
That's the podcast I want to be a part of.
But for fear, I'm gonna give it a 3. Like, there's a couple of, you know, jump scares and good kills, but it's not very scary.
Sure.
Except for maybe some of the stuff that used to pass for okay in the 80s. And then for God, I'm going to score it low, but it's just because the movie doesn't have a lot on its mind. I'm going to give it a 6 because I think that the themes that we discussed are there, but it's very loosely connected.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why we preference the fog meter. It's like we're not grading quality. There's such a tendency to be like, oh, but I like this film, so I want to rate it high. No, this is how demanding it is of the viewer. Nathan, I'll let you go last. I'll do mine now. I think for fear, I'm with you. I'm gonna up it a little bit and give it a 4 for fear, because I do think that the few kill sequences that are in there, while they're not scary, I do think there's some tension. There's some suspense. You don't quite know what's going to happen. And especially towards the end, some of that is very, very well staged. So, it can be kind of jarring. You're not going to walk away this film and have nightmares. Not at all. But I liked the staging of those. So I'll give it a 4 for that. I agree with you about the your expression of the God meter as well. I'm going to give this a 5 on that front. I feel like the film's intention is to have a lot of fun. And I feel like because of how thoughtfully they've constructed the narrative and the script and everything, I think some organic themes emerged out of that for people who watch movies the way we watch these movies. But I think it would be a bridge too far to say that this is what they're trying to say with the film. I don't feel that, except for maybe the text part that I would note that, like, hey, change can be a good thing. And like, it's not necessarily all bad that things are going to change. I do think that is text of the film, not just an extrapolation. But yeah, so 5 for me on the God meter. Nathan, where do you land with both?
Even just your comment there makes me think of Nana Connie and it makes me teary. So fear, I'm going to go, all right, I was going to go 3. I'm going to go 2.5. Let me rephrase that. I was going to go 2, and then I thought 3, and I'm going to split the difference. I don't think it's scary, but I do think, Reed, you put this in my brain, I think the sequence in the cabin when he finally shows up is well staged and realized. And I also think in the Dollhouse of Horrors, the culmination of that is pretty well executed. If we're talking kind of fearful stuff. However, I think the design of the killer and some of the cinematography quibbles I'd have undercut some of that kind of tension. Sure. and what might otherwise be there. I do want to take up the opportunity, because I forgot to elsewhere, to highlight in the Dollhouse of Horrors the hilarious moment that when the killer does kill Marissa, they have this really big buildup about the rape whistle multiple times. The rape bell, what is it called? The buzzer.
The rape alert.
Yes, rape alert multiple times. That he comes behind, slashes her throat, and she just holds the rape whistle as she falls to the ground. You know, it's like just a really great bit of staged humor there. So 2.5 for the fear meter. I'm gonna go 4 or 5 on the God meter. Again, it's not the conceit itself is going to yield some good fruit, and we're seeing that.
Yeah. And so obviously that means that we on the fog meter give this a 4 out of 10, which again, I'll emphasize, does not necessarily reflect the quality or enjoyment of the film, but rather how much you have to brace yourself to watch a film like this. And on that note, I think 4 out of 10 is quite on point for Totally Killer. But I mean, let's just be open here for a second. Like, after this discussion, where are we at on this movie? Nathan, I'll let you go first. After this talk and after watching it one time, like, where are you at on Totally Killer?
I'm pretty warm towards it. I think that, you know, given better context for the viewing, which is largely, you know, that's just circumstantial and life, and arguably viewer fault, viewer error there. I think I would have been much more open to it. I think it recovered well from those initial few minutes for me. Into a place of like, no, that was very solid. You know, some of the production elements I wish were a little different, but the heart of what is there is pretty strong.
Absolutely. Vera, what about you? Where are you at on this movie?
I still love this movie, and I will definitely revisit it. And I feel like it's a movie that, because it's so horror light, I can introduce to most of my friends who are not horror watchers, which is nice.
Honestly, I'm right there with you. Save what we've already referenced on, like, the, you know, the rampant fellatio innuendo. I would love to show this to my son, so when he gets maybe a little bit older and can, you know, handle the dirty jokes a little bit better. Yeah, especially following this conversation, my second viewing raised up my affection for it, which only further solidified that it rewards repeat viewings. It's very light on its feet. It asks very little of you to buy into it, and I think gives you a lot back. And that is some of the highest praise I can give films these days, because there's a lot of very demanding films out there. This is not one of them. This is meant to be fun, meant to be popcorn. Enjoy yourself. Don't think too hard about it. The time travel is just the time travel. Oh, it needed another metal conductor. Okay, yeah, good. I got it. You know, like, that's the time travel. So yeah, I think this film is fantastic, and I'm really, really glad we had the chance to talk about it. So
me
yeah,
too.
Super cool. Super cool. Or as we say, totally killer. Yeah. Totally killer. Cowabunga. So next week, as is the pattern for wide swath of the opposite end of the spectrum. Totally Killer is a breezy hour, 45 minutes. It is very non-demanding. It is very, like, it doesn't ask almost anything of you. You're just gonna, you know, just pop the popcorn and enjoy yourself. Next week, we are going to go to, listen, if you've seen Hereditary, and if you've seen Midsommar, then...
Oh, no.
I don't even think they could prepare you for next week's film, which is the 3-hour-long film starring Joaquin Phoenix, directed by yes, that's written and directed by Ari Aster. Bo is Afraid. Next week we are going to get, it is a wild, wild film. Whatever you can try to prepare yourself for, don't bother. It's just it's. It's wild. It's absolutely wild. And I'm very, very excited to talk about it for all of those reasons. But Bo is Afraid is what we're going to talk about next week. For the patrons, prepare yourself for Fall of the House of Usher episode 7, which is titled The Pit and the Pendulum. There is no switcheroo on this. Read the Edgar Allan Poe short story, The Pit and the Pendulum, to prepare for that. But there is extra credit, Nathan. There is extra credit on next week's episode. He's not going to do it.
Challenge accepted.
But it is actually relative to narrative as opposed to merely symbolic. So next week, Pit and the Pendulum is the story you need to read. You might, you know, benefit from also reading his story called Berenice. So that is the name of a character from that story, but Pit and the Pendulum to read for next week's patron segment, Berenice as well. And that is to prepare for episode 7 of The Fall of the House of Usher, titled The Pit and the Pendulum. As always, Vera, thank you so much for being here. This is always such a blast to have you on. Nathan, as always, thank you very much. And listener, thank you as well. As we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And in that spirit, we encourage you, urge you, you know, dare I say, implore you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. We will see you all next week, everybody. Bye.
See you guys. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation, and you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. Start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for links to our social media and episode archive, essays, merchandise, and more. If you love what we do, consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/thefearofgodpodcast, where you will unlock exclusive bonus episodes, extended standard episodes, online events, and so much more. Special thanks to Jacob Hunt of TracerMatula.com for our artwork. Our assortment of talented musicians, Andrew Nelson, the Island Family, and Jackson Harper for our varied show tunes. And to Lee Wright and Reed Lackey for our theme music. Special thank you also to Tyler Smith at MoreThanOneLesson.com. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice. And if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody.